This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The Massachusetts Department of Correction has been violating the constitutional rights of inmates with mental illness. That is the finding of a report from U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts Andrew Lelling's office. The report's a result of a two-year investigation into mental health care for prisoners at several Massachusetts correctional facilities. And U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling joins us now. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So, Mr. Lelling, this document, it's difficult to read. It outlines instances of harsh treatment of those who are mentally ill while they're behind bars. Your report refers to, quote, a high concentration of harm in the areas that are supposed to be the most safe and therapeutic, end quote. Were you surprised by what you found in this investigation?
We were a little bit surprised. And the reason why I phrased it that way is that this sort of problem is persistent in corrections facilities across the United States, because what happens is you have a lack of money in state budgets and you have a lack of training for prison personnel. And often what that leads to is a breakdown in treatment for people who are in the midst of a mental health crisis. And so in my career at the department, I have seen that before. And that's the kind of thing that we saw here.
So in the report, there's an emphasis on people who are in mental health crisis. I'm married to a mental health practitioner. I know times of crisis call for, you know, responsive treatment, responsive care. Can you explain how the Department of Correction has failed inmates in those moments and with that kind of treatment?
Well, it's a systemic breakdown, and you put your finger right on it before, which is that one of the most interesting observations we made is that the people on mental health watch in the DOC system are supposed to be in the safest place, but because of systemic issues, they're actually in the unsafest place. The problem is that when people in general population in the jails are in a mental health crisis, they're placed under mental health watch, which means they're moved to a separate cell. And what is supposed to happen there is they're supposed to have, one, close supervision, and then, two, access to treatment to try to stabilize them and allay any suicidal feelings that they're having and get them back into general population. But that's not what happens. The mental health watch area, those cells that they use, essentially amount to what we used to call solitary confinement and now call restrictive housing, which if you leave someone there long enough can be extremely psychologically stressful. In addition to that, the supervision of those people, meaning corrections officers watching them either intermittently or full-time, was lacking, and the officers were leaving gaps in supervision that allowed people on mental health watch to hurt themselves because they weren't being observed. There was also a lack of care from mental health professionals. Maybe someone on mental health watch would see a therapist for 5 minutes on a given day and probably talk to them through, you know, an opening in the cell door, which is not really conducive to actual treatment.
And you have to report also... I just want to stop you there to add to that a little bit, because your report also suggested that people being under mental health watch still had access to objects that might allow for self-harm or even attempted suicide.
Yes, that's right. And so the procedures that most of the DOC facilities we saw were using were not sufficient to catch objects like razors or paper clips or other things that could be used for self-harm being smuggled into these mental health watch cells. And so we saw many, many instances in which inmates who already have psychological issues are placed in this more stressful environment where they're socially isolated and left to their own devices and their own thoughts and their own voices in their heads, and they have items they can use to harm themselves. And so that created the problems that you see itemized in the report.
And in that itemization, we are talking about a lot of instances. At one point, it says the DOC reported that prisoners engaged in self-harm 688 times while on mental health watch. And 4 of 8 who died of suicide were on mental health watch when they died. Can you give our listeners a sense of the magnitude of harm here?
Well, it is a high magnitude of harm in that the Department of Correction system clearly has problems that must be fixed, which is why we did the investigation and is why we issued the report. But again, unfortunately, you would find correctional systems across the United States that have similar problems. And so what we saw here, the problems we saw here, you can generally trace to a lack of training and a lack of funding. The lack of training is the lack of training of corrections officers who are supposed to deal with people who are having mental health issues, and they're not getting that training. The lack of funding stems maybe not primarily, but in large part, from the state of Massachusetts changing the definition of those who are entitled to mental health treatment in correctional settings in 2019, which increased the pool of people who need help, but the number of therapists and mental health professionals operating in the jails did not see a commensurate increase in resources. So you have too few therapists and too many inmates who need help. You put all this together and you have the rate of self-harm that we saw in the department's correctional system.
So with what you just laid out, especially comparing it with other states, I understand that you were then also saying that you didn't in your investigation find that these were willful or intentional situations. Am I understanding you correctly?
Yes, that's right. The DOC was extremely cooperative with our investigation. Cooperation is on a spectrum. You have investigations where correctional facilities are grudgingly cooperative or not cooperative, and then you have ones where they're genuinely cooperative, point you to what you need to see, help you see the relevant files, and that was what we had here. So they did a very good job with that. I'm hoping that will continue as we try to work out how to remedy these problems. So on an officer-by-officer basis, I think there was occasionally intentional misconduct, but that is not the overall story. It's really just people trying to do a good job in a system that has not given them great training and which is underfunded.
So you just talked about that level of cooperation. Here's Governor Baker. He did comment on the report today during a press conference he was holding. Here he is.
We are going to implement every recommendation that's in there. A lot of that stuff that he recommends and his folks recommended came out of dialogue and conversation that's taken place with DOC over the course of the investigation. And while we have focused real hard on a bunch of different things associated with DOC over the course of the past few years around criminal justice reform, managing COVID, and dealing with Bridgewater State Hospital, this is a fail that needs to get fixed.
So, you know, you pointed out that they cooperated. There's the governor owning it, saying this is a fail. But I do want to ask, did you encounter any areas doing this two-year investigation where the Mass Department of Correction dragged its feet, where you had trouble getting information? Are there pain points there we should be aware of?
No. We visited nearly every DOC facility over the course of the two-year investigation and looked at thousands of pages of incident reports, policies, training manuals. They gave us access to prisoners. We interviewed prisoners. We interviewed correction staff. The administration of Massachusetts Department of Corrections was extremely cooperative. I think in the report, you will see isolated instances where corrections officers committed intentional misconduct, or at least it seems that way to us. Sometimes they were appropriately reprimanded, sometimes not. That's something that DOC needs to work on. But overall, they were extremely cooperative. And so that's why I'm optimistic about making real strides toward remedying the situation. This isn't something you fix overnight, but I think you will see material progress in the relatively short term.
And can you explain for our listeners, you've said a few intentional instances, largely unintentional, but you drew the conclusion that there are violations of prisoners' constitutional rights going on here. Can you explain that?
The violation of constitutional rights, let me back up a step. If someone's incarcerated for a crime, the state is undertaking the responsibility for that person's care and well-being while they're in jail. You have to give them minimal, lodging, food, mental health care. Mental health care is included in that. They're entitled to that. And so what you have here is a failure to provide sufficient care. And you have a few different strands that came together to create a constitutional problem. So in short, because we've been discussing, the way these DOC facilities were treating patients in mental health crisis was actually greatly increasing the chance that they would harm themselves, that they would come to harm. And in that manner, these facilities were violating the constitutional rights of those who were in desperate need of mental health treatment. We're talking about inmates who were suicidal and then placed into conditions that exacerbated their suicidal tendencies. That's no one person's fault. It's a systemic breakdown. But that systemic breakdown led to unconstitutional conditions. And so that's what we're trying to fix.
Okay, and who's going to oversee the implementation of your recommendations? And what happens if things don't change or some of those recommendations aren't implemented?
Well, there are a few ways to get at this. That remains to be seen. So my staff here and some staff from Washington at the Justice Department are now in negotiations with the Department of Corrections to figure out how to implement what we think is needed to alleviate these problems. This usually results in a written agreement that is available to the public. That written agreement can be a private settlement agreement, essentially a contract between the Justice Department and the Massachusetts Department of Corrections. It can be a consent decree, so that is enforceable by a court. It can involve the appointment of an outside monitor who is given access to every corner of the DOC system and is tasked with making sure DOC meets whatever metrics we set in the written agreement. We don't always do that, but we do often do that, especially when you have a sprawling correctional system like this one. And so those are some tools in the toolbox. It's way premature to know what is going to be necessary or desired here in resolving this case. The fact that the state has been cooperative with us will make it easier to resolve it, but the devil's in the details about how to make sure these fixes get done.
Okay, and before we let you go here, I want to shift gears and ask you one other question. We have had a presidential election. The major media outlets have called that election for Joe Biden. President Trump has maintained the election was stolen from him, and he's the rightful winner. Attorney General William Barr issued a memo authorizing federal prosecutors to investigate allegations of voter fraud if they're credible. I want to ask you, do you recognize Joe Biden as the president-elect? And what happens in your office on January 20th? When the new president is inaugurated?
Well, I'm going to skip the first part, and I'm going to go to the second part, which won't surprise you. One of the great things about my jurisdiction extending only to the four corners of the state of Massachusetts is that I can confine my comments to the four corners of the state of Massachusetts. As to the second point, what usually happens with United States attorneys is after the new administration comes in, at some point they will ask any remaining U.S. attorneys to leave. Somebody can check me on this, but I think when the Trump administration came in, whatever Obama U.S. attorneys were remaining were asked to leave in March or April of 2017. My guess, and it really is just a guess, is that about the same thing is going to happen here. So all the U.S. attorneys are now lame duck. We're all thinking about what comes next. You know, most of us will begin to slowly go out the door and look for jobs in the private sector or elsewhere. And those that remain, I think, in the early spring will probably be asked to set a date for departure so that the new slate of political appointees under the new president can come in.
Well, U.S. Attorney for the District of Massachusetts, Andrew Lelling, I know these are busy times. Thanks for taking some time for us today.
Thanks for having me.